third party about some of those hard issues, but if you get us all in the room talking about what they are, you know, would, could, should we have triggered the dispute resolution? I still believe that at that time, and I was very new to it, I was being advised largely by my caucus who'd already been into it for a year and a half or however long they'd been focused on it, that we were, the issues were starting to blow up. And the scope of the dispute was starting to just look like this could go into another many years of protracted discussion, and I think we felt that putting the dispute resolution timeline on the issue highlighted both the fundamental nature of the issue, we believe, to the program and the need to get this issue resolved and on an equal sort of footing with the other issues that were coming down the pike. And it seemed to me that it was, the other issues are more discreet. I mean, the postmortem, we had a piece of information. We had to decide whether there was a policy response required. That is a lot different than basically, you know, sort of revisiting what we should do now in light of a condition proceeding that never occurred, which was the adoption of the policy. And every party, absolutely every party, had a different perspective on what we should do. So that's where we ended up. So I guess I feel like we did the best we could. I'm sorry if I don't have a different answer, but I feel like, and I also feel like we probably could have extended another 3 months, another 6 months. I cannot tell you that we would have been in a very different place from where we are now. And so I think we're trying to enlist your help to join us and help us help ourselves to like this.
Or is nothing if not help. Other questions for Conservation Caucus? Thanks, Mary. I would like next to see the industry landowner caucus. Karen Tolodner.
Good morning, Chairman Everett and members of the board. I'm Karen Tolodner with the WFPA, and I represent the Industrial Landowner Caucus at Policy.
Thanks, Karen. Questions of the industry planner caucus before I launch into my usual monologue.
Can I have pickles?
Can you have what?
Pickles. On the cheeseburger.
No, you may not. Condiments are a different department.
You didn't say comms department?
You didn't say please.
Is it not the desire of the landowner caucus to have a permanent water testing system?
It is the desire of the landowners to have an understandable, enforceable, transparent water typing system. I think the disagreement that our caucus may have with others is what that looks like. And you had asked, and various folks have talked a little bit about the water typing system and why this is such a big dispute. And my opinion is that it's because this is a fundamental piece of the FFR, it's a fundamental piece of the HCP, and if we are really talking about changing the water typing system in a significant way, then we need to have as much information as we can to be able to do that. That said, I think that my caucus would believe that the current system as it works, works well. And one of the issues that we have repeatedly brought to the table, one of the questions has been, what are the issues? What are the substantive issues? What are the technical issues? What are the data-related issues in terms of why we need to change the water typing system? Now, I'm an attorney like Mary, and the fact that we have two different administrative rules for a water typing system just seems crazy. One of the things that Mary and I probably agree about is that in 2005, the board didn't do the system a lot of favors in terms of moving forward in something that made more sense. But in terms of what we do on the ground, we think that we protect habitat. We don't think that there are significant problems. We are willing and eager to listen to areas where there may be some data coming forward to be able to express what those issues might be. But what we've found over the last year, I think, is that we've really devolved into this sort of war or battle over individual words rather than looking at outcomes on the ground.
So if I can paraphrase, you're approaching the issue as a need for change issue, but there is no dispute among the landowner caucuses or the industry landowner caucus about the need to have a permanent water technical rule that meets the objectives of forest and fish and the agency.
There's not a dispute in terms of having a permanent water typing rule that meets the needs of forest and fish. I think that what you may have in some parts of my caucus is a dispute over whether we don't have a permanent rule at this point in time. Because the interim rule, even though it's called an interim rule, is a permanent administrative rule that is in process. Now again, as I said, there are two different pieces. It does, but it's a permanent administrative rule.
It doesn't go away. It
doesn't go away.
True. Other questions for the landowner caucus? Thanks, Karen.
Yeah.
If we have questions later, I assume the caucus.
Yes.
We can recall a witness.
I see that one of our representative of our federal partners have joined us, and we'd like to have Bridget come and talk with us. You would, as a representative of the federal office. Okay. Official Fish and Wildlife Service guard.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. It's nice to see you all. I thought I would provide clarity of my agency.
So we got a letter from you this morning. You want to walk us through that?
We did.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate distributing that to the board members. The intent of that letter was to, one, acknowledge the fact that we, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and likely more broadly the Federal Caucus, and just have not had a broader opportunity to close ranks, but we are wanting to inform you and the board that we need a permanent water typing rule. We don't believe we have one. I do respect the legal statement that we have an officially, you know, we have an actual rule that does not go away, but I would still call that the interim rule. So we wanted to recognize that we have some concerns with the existing system. Those are spelled out in the letter, use of electrofishing, unclear guidance or implementation of the interim rule, and the fact that we had in the HCP a commitment to have it in a permanent rule. So we acknowledge that those concerns exist for the Federal Caucus and that you have demonstrated the desire to fix that. We appreciate that and we stand ready to work with you. So that's essentially what the letter says.
And tell me about the concerns around the electric fishing in broad strokes. I think the memos outline them, but from the services perspective.
Sure. One of the things that's probably most important for the board to be aware of is that we, the service, have issued you an incidental take permit for your habitat conservation plan. In so doing, we had to analyze what that action was that we were undertaking, we, the Fish and Wildlife Service, by authorizing your permit. When we did that, we analyzed very specific activities that would be occurring under that permit. What that means is that when we issued the permit, all of those activities that we analyzed and gave you coverage for are those that are described and analyzed in our biological opinion and the HCP. Electrofishing is not a covered activity. So we wanted to be very clear with you that while we knew at the beginning of the HCP that there was the use of electrofishing, that activity would go away and that you have no coverage for that activity. And so we wanted essentially, you know, stay between the lines is sort of the message I've been telling people. You had an activity that was sort of right on the edge of that line at the beginning because we knew you had to transition from one system to another system. We knew there was the use of electrofishing. We analyzed that in, I believe, a 2-year or 5-year window of change. Well, we're well past that now and we're still, I would say, debating whether we should even be using it. So it's not an activity that you have coverage for, so we're trying to direct you, you know, back between the lines to stay within what we authorized so that you have ESA coverage.
Okay. Mr. Thorpe.
Hi, Richard. Would electro fishing be something that could come within the lines if it was used within certain protocols and parameters? I mean, is it something that, because it wasn't analyzed, there was a decision early on that it could never make, could never cross into the acceptable? Or is it something that, if it was used in certain places and at certain times, might be?
Yeah, I don't think it's a black and white line explicitly. I'd have to go back and look at the exact language, to be honest, to really see precisely what we said. But I understand that's part of the new plan here, to propose an idea of looking at limited use or how that tool could be used in a more restrictive capacity. You know, we stand open to have that dialogue, but I don't think it's a black and white line.
Bridget, how does it tie in on covered species that to do electrofishing, you have to get a scientific collection permit through the feds and the state? Isn't there an overlap there on coverage?
Again, we'd have to sort of look at each one of those permits to see how the board and the forest practices, Forest and Fish HCP, does not cover those activities, but individuals who go and get that scientific collection permit would have ESA coverage for that. We do authorize that, but it is not a covered activity for forest practices. It's one by one for those who get that permit. Yes.
Other questions for Ms. Moran?
Aaron, this is Paula. I have a question.
Go ahead.
Bridget, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I did. I now see your name by the phone and understand what that means.
Okay.
I was wondering where you were.
So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the services, the extent to which the service has concerns about fish habitat not being properly identified. So unauthorized take might be occurring through the lack of proper buffers.
Is that your question?
Yep.
I really can't get too far down into the details on that. I'm not briefed up enough to really go into that in the level of detail that I think maybe you would like me to or have a better understanding of. But I would say that fish habitat needs to be buffered, and the permanent water typing rules identify where the need for the permanent water typing rules would clarify where we have a need for that type of protection. So I don't know enough to say today whether I think fish habitat is or is not being protected properly de facto here in front of the board, but I would say that I wrote that letter today to share it with you for this meeting to indicate that we believe we need a permanent water typing rule and we don't have one.
A follow-up,
okay.
Paul?
Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you, and we do stand ready here at the federal government to support the implementation of the HCP. We're very strong supporters of it, and want to let you know that. Thanks.
I would like next to see Jim Peters, please. Jim Slade. Morning.
Good morning. Jim Peters, Northwest Indian Fish Commission.
I appreciated the memo that the board got from you and from the West Side Tribes. I think it has a number of reasonable follow-up steps. I wanted to ask, though, and all of you, you'll forgive me if I get too far down into the weeds about a couple of little pieces of it. And specifically, I was thinking of the third recommendation on the first page, where statements made that once a stream is verified to have fish, there should be no further effort to determine fish presence or absence. Can you describe for me what the sense of the tribes is about once an initial determination is made, the follow-up water type mod changes? What's the process? Tell me a little bit more, if you can, about the sort of process of concern there.
Well,
Well, I think part of it is because of the possibly the documentation of that getting on a map and then somebody else coming in and trying to do something and then bringing in a modification to downgrade when in previous surveys was already done to show fish presence. And so although they came in after the fact and did another protocol or survey of some sort and didn't find fish, that shouldn't be trumping previous data that came in that verified that there was fish in the area.
So is that within one water type mod, or are we talking about two separate water type mods that take place over time, or is it multiple passes on the survey?
I'm not quite sure. I don't know.
Nancy, do you
think they're separate surveys?
Separate surveys, yeah.
Within the same water type mod?
Yeah.
Different water type mods.
Different ones. So successive water type mods.
It's already in half when someone comes in and surveys.
Following on that, on the current conduct of the water type modification process, can you give me a sense of how tribes feel about the interdisciplinary team component of that review? Or is the implementation on the ground happening in a way that's consistent with tribal biologists' estimation of fish habitat, or are there widespread complaints about how things are working or things going okay?
I think part of it is that when they get out on the ground, they work those issues out, and I believe to the most part we're pretty successful with that type of process. So it's but that's where some of the disagreement comes is when we're going out in the field because it's not spelled out simply enough that this is the process that you go through. And so you got to spend the time to go out there and have those discussions. I know in some cases when you go out there and deal with a couple different issues on ID teams and things like that, sometimes it's the last thing on the list. And some of the tribes are kind of going, "Wow, we're just gonna drop that one at this point." But if it was a little bit easier for people to understand what the process and the guidelines were to initially do some of that stuff, I think a lot of those issues would go away, and we're just doing some clarifications on the field.
I've asked pretty much everyone else who's come up why we had this dispute in front of the board. And I'd like your been around policy a long time, been around these issues a long time. I'd like your perspective on it. If you want to share it.
Yeah, and I think in some cases. There was a trust issue at times. I think sometimes we, and this isn't to downgrade people's concerns about certain words and stuff, but I think sometimes we spend way too much time in trying to get the right word in there, the commas and all that type of stuff. And I'm not a wordsmithing type of person. I want to get the intent. I want to agree on the intent, let people work on that. Type of things to bring something forward that we all agree on. The other part, and I've mentioned this with our policy group too, is we have to maybe go back a little bit to the TFW days when we were actually having a very successful process of all working together. And part of that is that you check your weapons at the door. Part of that is words, some of those, using words as a weapon, that could be a part of that definition. Part of that definition was attorneys wanting to get, certain words, and again, this is the weapons of doing that. I think the other part is also going back to when you bring in an issue. We all have to kind of try to work on and commit to resolving each other's issues. Part of that also is to listen, ask clarifying questions, not to necessarily challenge what a statement that was made, but to get a better understanding of what the other caucuses are trying to request. And then after getting all that clarification, come together, working together on trying to solve everybody's issues there. Obviously, at some times we can't do that, and that's where I think the value, you know, it's valuable to have a dispute resolution process. But again, that's only going to be successful as it is defined in the issue that we're dealing with. So maybe getting back to those basic type of things that was successful in our past, we just got to recommit, and part of that is getting the principals back involved. Getting, you know, back in TFW days, it was the CEOs of the companies and the landowners, even the small landowners being there. It was the fish, natural resources biologists, the directors of the agencies that were the true policy people in timber, fish, and wildlife. And then we had an administrative group, and then we had a scientist group. And there was a lot of checks and balances in my time where somebody stepped out of bounds on a rule or something like that, those caucuses went down and got them back in line and was able to do it. Hoping that the forest and fish would actually solve some of our issues that wasn't working well at timber, fish, and wildlife. But I think part of it is we didn't adopt some of the other ones. It's like by getting and re-engaging some of those principles to kind of whip us in shape a little bit when we are stepping out. And it's not just one caucus. It's back in there. It's every caucus, the state caucus, tribal, industry. All of us stepped out of line at one time, and our lead policy people stepped in and brought them back in into the protocols and stuff. So, but that's a big commitment. We have to get that commitment from everybody above.
Yeah, for the benefit of the board members, in my own personal conversations with individual policy caucuses and our staff's conversation with individual policy caucuses, I don't think there's one who hasn't expressed the sentiment that you've just expressed, Jim, that we've spent an awful lot of time and energy making the perfect the enemy of the good, or however you want to characterize it. And so there seems to be some broad recognition of that, but it doesn't seem like a lot of action on it. And so I don't know what your thoughts might be about how we break through that. At least we're starting with some recognition. I think the board needs to see a change. And we've been talking about it here for a while. Maybe taking some decisive action on this issue is a way to engender some change. But there's recognition, but not action, in my observation. What do you think is holding up?
Well, I think part of it is we just each caucus has to make that a priority and get their principals to come to a meeting and go across the board. That's again going back, and I know the tribes and the industry tried to kind of spark that up a few years ago, and it didn't really go very far. I think there was a misunderstanding of what we were trying to achieve, and some other things kind of got bunched into that meeting, and so maybe we just try to do that again. And I know the Lands Commissioner was involved in that a little bit. But maybe we can keep focus on this forest and fish, the timber, fish, and wildlife agenda. We should be able to get the full attention of those principles and maybe work something out.
Questions for Jim? Mr. Stork?
Morning, Jim. Looking at the Westside Tribal comments, I want to check perception or, you know, a conclusion that I came to. It looks like you guys are saying that the LIDAR-based model at best is just going to provide a coarse screen, and that would imply a fairly significant continued presence on the ground, whether that's electrofishing or some other evaluation on the ground. Is that accurate?
I think we think that LIDAR is one of those technologies that we should look into, and how it is used. It should be used as a tool, the way we look at it. So if it's combined with other tools, things like that. We think that that might be able to pick up some of the type of stuff. You know, all I know is what I've seen of it, and I just thought that was the coolest thing that was ever invented, where you could actually see some historical channels and then figure out why they weren't channels anymore, and it might have been some earthquake that blocked it, or you know, things like that. But I think by utilizing that type of technology, I think would be very helpful for us.
Thank you.
Questions for Jim?
But you don't see it replacing people in the streams?
No. I think, you know, in my experience of talking with all the biologists that was either at Squaxin Island or being out working for DNR at one time and the foresters and stuff like that, I think that is where as much as you can, you know, get away from doing that, that's great. But when you have a question or something, I think you still got to have the boots out on the ground and everybody working together and resolving those issues. Many ID teams out there where, especially when I was working for DNR, where there was major disputes between the landowner and the tribe and the agencies, and everybody had a difference of opinion, and me going out and witnessing this, thinking there's no way there's going to be resolution on this, and the forester going to have to make a call and question it. Okay, what kind of call are they going to, you know, use this information from that, you know, landowner or this or that? I was very pleased that probably 99% of the time, those guys worked it out on the field. And even though it was very divisive before they went out there and being able to just do that. So I think that needs to continue on. And then that just builds relationship and trust as we go on.
Mr. Cook.
So, Jim, what would your feelings be if we moved to using the LIDAR technology, but there was some period where your concerns may be able to be addressed by using LIDAR, having boots on the ground, and then over time, hypothetically, we'd find that you would develop more confidence in the LIDAR results? Would that something you might be interested in?
Oh yeah, and that would just be, you know, as people get to know how those tools are being used and the confidence behind it. Because I know in other arenas in natural resources management, models are used all the time, and there's a lot of confidence in those. However, you know, some of those models need to be rerun at times because of different environmental situations out there. And so you start losing that kind of confidence. So I think if, you know, as people get confident in the tools that are out there, it'll just build on itself and it'll still be great. I still think, though, you're never going to get away from going out there and out in the field. I still think that's important.
Right.
Because then it's that human communication and stuff is valuable, not just, you know, for, you know, verifying a question here or there. But again, I go back to the relationships. That's where some of these relationships and these trusts start to build up. You know, so there's going to be maybe just a phone call because of the trust. And they talk it out, saying, okay, fine, we're good with it.
Yeah, hopefully, I think the end goal would be to have something, I think, you know, use of LIDAR, and then over time, develop the confidence that can be shared by everyone so that we can reduce as much as possible that field presence. Not ever saying that, you know, the use of LIDAR would totally replace in all circumstances, having people on the ground to try to get that to areas where we just don't have the confidence that model.
But I think part of that is planning too. You know, having people plan ahead of time, just showing up in an office and looking at maps and people knowing the landscapes and stuff, and planning ahead of time with utilizing all those tools too.
Thanks, Jim.
Yeah, thank you.
I would like next to speak with Mark Godier from Columbia United Tribes.
Hello, Board. Thank you for allowing me this time to chat with you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I had, I understand from the content of the number of recommendations and memos and letters that we've got that there's a continued desire to use electrofishing or some method of field verification sort of based on a guidance map. But concern that for the part of the services, we don't have the coverage for it. For the part of the Upper Columbia United Tribes memo, that a single pass survey fails to identify habitat that might be used by fish in all cases. Those things I find to be in tension. It's not much of a surprise to me why we haven't quite been able to agree on the continued use of electrofishing. What you suggest using physical criteria instead in your memo. Tell me whether electrofishing is a tool that is acceptable to use on some limited basis going forward, or not acceptable at all, or what's your perspective on electrofishing?
Yeah, and I'll also just share that I'm maybe one of the few policy members that actually spends a lot of time in the field and field reviews a lot of these and have been in these debates in the field, so I might have some experience that's helpful. So I think part of the logic is that physicals are something that we can all go out and measure together and come out in complete agreement in. You take your 10 measurements, come up with your average. When you hit 3 foot, for example, on our side, we can walk out of the woods all in agreement and feeling good about the result. And part of the problem with the electrofishing is, depending on the time of year, we have a lot of seasonal streams in eastern Washington, and it's very hard to find a forester that believes that a stream that doesn't have water in it has the potential to have fish. So right there's an immediate obstacle. But the tribes have proven indeed that there are seasonals. So, but then you even go further to that seasonal variability, and then starting with the model, you know, showing what the model predicts, and there's multiple examples where the model called something an N, and then the landowner's just going off the model and not verifying whether or not there's fish present or not. And we've done multiple, and we could go on a field trip and I could take you to them that are, you know, 4 foot bank full width and loaded with fish, but the model called it an end. So there are landowners, you know, different landowners have different opinions, but there are landowners that look at the cost of electrofishing, the disagreements and the constant ID teams, and have at least told me in confidence in person that physicals would be a good solution for them too. So it's not just us that have kind of settled in on that concept, but it seems like the most logical, repeatable, enforceable, and also encompasses the concept of shared risk. Because, for example, on our side, the 3 foot, we do find smaller than 3 foot that does have fish. On occasion, you're gonna hit a situation where maybe a 4 foot doesn't have fish. But there's often a reason for that. And so if we were able to determine what a permanent natural barrier is and say, okay, if there's fish downstream and there's nothing physically preventing them from getting up there, and without having to come in the winter and 4 or 5 times during a season to really verify that, the physical seem like the fairest way to incorporate that shared risk. So that's our perspective on that.
Did it come up in dispute resolution that maybe different folks' view of the world as far as the accuracy of the physicals might differ among east side and west side application of the physicals? And is that fleshed out at all in discussions?
It got discussed. I guess the only real way to validate that would be to do some validation in the field to know absolutely for sure. But what I do know is when those rules were adopted based on the research that I've done, there was some scientific backing for making that determination of 3 and 2 feet, and there was a reason that they chose a different footage on the east side than the west side. you'd sure hope. So it just seems like a logical solution to mitigate the disagreements. And that's one point that I really wanted to share with the board. Coming from the field, and this is coming from DNR staff to forest landowners, that these disagreements do impact us in the field. And although we are, the ID teams do work and we are able to come out with an answer, it often results in frayed relationships. And so, as you can imagine, for example, me as a tribal bio, as those potential relationships fray a little bit because they're not really happy with the position that I might have taken based on the interpretation of the rules, maybe they're less apt to answer the phone call next time to allow me to come to their lands. So there's some real consequences to all our tribal bios by not being able to have agreement in the field. So even though the ID teams work, there is ramifications and impacts. And I think that's important for everybody to be aware of.
Questions for Mark? How come we have this dispute?
I'd like to share an example from at least my personal perspective and my tribe's perspectives. I'm going to use the stream associated wetlands as the example, and that when you read 030 and 031, they're both clearly called out as to be protected as type F waters. And so again, I've only been in the program for 3 years, but I've been tasked by my tribes to ensure that we're fulfilling the rules and obligations. So I read that language, I say this is the rule, therefore we're supposed to be out there protecting stream associated wetlands. And then even take it another step further, and I went and did the 2-day training from the DNR hosted by Dave Parks, where they're training us exactly how to do that. Dig the soil pits, where to mark your lines. I did it with foresters, landowners, there was like 20 of us, and we all came out of that feeling really good about understanding how you delineate a stream associated wetland. Well, then when I went back and said, well, where in the rule can I point to this? So when I'm out with a landowner and they're disagreeing with me, can I show them where it says it in the rule language? No, there is nothing. And apparently there was guidance that was supposedly created 7-8 years ago that has never seen the light of day. And so that's where it becomes really problematic. Then I also participate in compliance monitoring. So we also can't conduct compliance monitoring on these sites because there's no rule to directly point to. So although we're doing the training, it's clear in 030 and 031 when you read it on its face, yet we can't completely do our jobs, you know. So that's why, from my perspective, we had a disagreement, because we couldn't agree to that we were both reading 030 and 031 the same, that we needed guidance for stream associated wetlands. And so it's pretty hard to get there.
Questions for Mark? Other Mark, show us what's behind door number one. Patricia's going to do is leave it up on the screen over lunch, so board members and other interested folks can have a look at it. Chew on it over lunch along with everything else you need to chew on. We'll come back and do it after. There are also hard copies of Patricia's
Okay.
over there, so let's pass those out to the board now, if we would.
At the request of the chair, board staff has prepared a draft motion for it's mostly short, but it's a and is there an extra copy of these if needed? Okay, I got old eyes. So the motion. Is actually in keeping with the conversation today and what many of the policy participants have stated to the board, that perhaps breaking this entire issue into smaller pieces is a good idea. And it's also an acknowledgement that we really do need more information in order to make an informed decision, and that some of the quantitative information would be good. In other words, what is really happening out there? Is there a way that we can really determine what's going on in the field? So to quickly go down to the very first number one, be that the policy work plans be amended to reflect the following work. First would be the policy complete recommendations for option on permanent water typing rule, beginning with two tasks. And that these tasks, the progress of these tasks, be reported to the board at the main meeting. The first is the development of best practices or recommendations regarding protocol survey electrofishing, including evaluation of all published literature, minimizing specific or potential site-specific impacts, and options for reducing the overall extent of the survey's use. I might add that informing of Section 13 is the protocol survey process. And many of the issues that people are questioning are actually covered in the manual, so that is a good source document for a policy to look at, to break into parts, discuss the adequacy of the model. If you stop me if you have any questions. The second part of this would be an evaluation of the process to identify off-channel habitat under the interim and rule, including recommended clarifications and field implementation guidance or rule language. In your board packet, the chair provided a table, and in the table is a summary of how off-channel habitat is presented both in the permanent rule, which is 030, as well as the interim rule, 031. Now, a little history. In 2005, when the board was looking at the results of the model for the west side, and the model was done in two parts, western Washington and then eastern Washington. The original conversations were around western Washington, and the fact that in the running of the model, there was also a lot of work to spatially correct streams. The original hydro maps showed in instances where streams were flowing uphill and in the wrong locations, things of that sort. So there was a lot of work to put the streams in their proper location in addition to the running of the model. But the model that we, or the maps that we now have today, are based on that model, and they just indicate type S, F, and N waters. That's in keeping with 031, because when you read 031, there's a table in there, and it states that for the purposes of the interim rule, and I will specifically pick on type F waters is the combination of stream types 2 and 3. And in our map, you don't see N, P, and N as it just says N. The reason why DNR recommended the board embrace the S, F, and M concept is that we wanted to make sure that people were using the correct water type maps. We didn't want a mixing of the old maps, which were type 1 through 5, with this new map, which at the very least had streams spatially correct for the most part. So, I'll keep going. The off-channel habitat here is associated with type F waters, which would be 2, 3, or F, is the need to identify and protect off-channel habitat adequate. I don't think at this time the board's looking for policy to come back and give you a wide range of what would constitute off-channel habitat, just that direction to make sure to identify off-channel habitat and to protect it under both the interim and eventually the permanent rule. So thank you, Chair, for bringing me back. Detailed history lesson. Sorry. Okay. There's a the next part to the motion is directing policy to the Adaptive Management Program Administrator is directed to work with board staff and others as needed to scope and initiate the pilot project to rerun the existing model using LiDAR data. And that it would be in at least two watersheds, one west side and one east side. At this time, we don't envision that there'd be a purchase of LiDAR, it'd be using high-quality LiDAR that can be found within specific watersheds. So, and I, rather than going through A, B, C, and D in detail, this is asking that this data be collected, that the, after the model is run, that we then compare it to the original model, to and to the water typing as being applied through forest practice applications and water type modification forms, and then look at how well the new model would, when overlaid over these, would define that break between F and N water.
At a number of different points in the conversations we've had with policy representatives, I think Jim was the latest to mention it, or Mark was the latest to mention Cody was the latest to mention it. The board has an administrative choice in front of it on as we progress toward a permanent water typing system. Between this idea of map as rule, as is embodied in the resource objectives from Forest and Fish and the HCP, and whether that's feasible, whether we can construct a model that achieves that level of precision. I think you've heard from some of the policy folks some skepticism about that. I have my own skepticism about that, but you know, the base data that are available to us now as compared with those that generated the map that we have right now are, you know, they're worlds apart in terms of their precision and accuracy. So this will help inform us about that, or whether we need to find a way to pivot ourselves into the world of continuing to use, you know, maybe that improved data as guidance, and then this continual process of adjusting the grade through field procedures of some kind or another. That's a basic administrative choice that the board's going to have to make. Clearly, we've committed ourselves in Forest and Fish and the HCP to this model approach, so we need to have some good information in front of us when it's time to make that choice, if we're going to choose something different than what was in there, because it may or may not be something that's feasible. So I think this pilot component of the motion informs us about any number of the different policy and field implementation questions that have been found in the policy discussion. We need to, in the last part of the motion, authorize some near-term funding between now and the 2014 board meeting so that the AMPA can move ahead with not only just scoping the project, but initiating the project. We don't have any money to do that, but it'll work. And then we set a timetable, a time-bound completion of the pilot by the August 2014 board meetings. These are both in the policy tasks and in the quantitative tasks. These are pretty ambitious timelines. There was a lot of squeal. I think we should do it. So those are the broad strokes. Do you have any questions before we break for lunch? Mr. Stork.
We'll come back and have a full discussion, hear people's comments.
Okay. Just make a comment about process, and I'll be brief, but Jim Peters was mentioning earlier about TFW, and Aaron, you asked about what can we do and make it work. And thinking back to that process, as he mentioned, we had a policy group, and we had an administrative group, and we had a science group. And Stu Bledsoe led the team for WFPA, and we had Jim Waldo and Billy Frank there. But policy often said to admin and the science group, if you don't fix this, we will. And that scared the bejeebas out of the admin group and the science group, so we went off and solved problems because we didn't want policy to have to solve them. I think today we are the policy group, so sometimes processes need a kick start and some action, and there was some discussion earlier about whether this was ripe or not. I was on the board in 2001 when we passed this original rule, and it's been a long time. We just need to keep this moving, so I'm very much appreciative of your efforts to move it forward, and I do think it does reside properly here at this point to to kickstart and move it forward, because we have an obligation to make sure we follow through with what we said we were going to do. And so I just thank you for that, and I just wanted to lend that perspective on TFW, and that's how the process works. So we have a success here, not a failure process. So,
thanks. Any other questions before we break for lunch? See you back here at 1 o'clock. Thanks.
You know, it comes down to a battle of a fine control and scalpel.
Well, and the thing I said earlier this morning, so it's very, very helpful to have a discussion. And I think the intent of both, not all parties, are the same. I want to get the order right.
That's the problem. We're the ones that are able to deal with the sharp tool. It's a field service. But the blunt rule is only 2 feet or 3 feet. I think we need to explore it.
Well, I think it is a piece of the toolbox, electrification, because if the fish are wandering, you understand that.
Anyway.
I don't have any water in them.
Oh, no.
5 months out of the year. Maybe they're fishing.
Interesting.